I first encountered the Reverend Dr. Christine Smith at Princeton Theological Seminary in the mid-1980s. She was the deep-voiced preaching professor standing far away at the front of that lecture hall. Then I met her again as the instructor of the preaching practicum group to which I had been assigned. So let me make that clear for my preaching students, past and future. You are today meeting my seminary preaching professor. This is to say that Chris Smith provided a marvelous homiletical experience, though probably not the norm for a Princeton homiletical experience. Several years later, many of us pastors traveled to cold Minneapolis in November of 1994, and we saw Chris again, this time preaching and speaking in a hotel ballroom surrounded by some 2,000 women gathered for the famous or notorious reimagining conference. Chris was not out as a lesbian. She thought for that conference it would be too self-centered of her to use her speaking and preaching in that way, but in a sense was lovingly called out by panelists, friends, loved ones in the midst. And that final sermon that day, Chris, the final speaker, was bringing her personal political preaching, coming out self, into our midst. And now, if I'm lucky, I see her each year at our Professional Society for Preachers, where she is a passionate colleague in conversation, as she is a swing dance partner post-banquet hours. Chris is the past president of the Academy of Homiletics, and during her presidential year, she made sure that we did not meet in comfortable San Francisco, but instead that we gathered in Oakland, known for other things. Her agenda was preaching justice, and she put together a panel of persons, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, who spoke to us about church and the preaching task. There are many ways to introduce Chris Smith, but my educational ministries colleagues here at LTS helped me out by guiding me to one scholar who names three curriculum that are involved in any educational endeavor: the explicit curriculum, the implicit curriculum, and the null curriculum. Chris Smith constantly brings all three to the table: those things spoken, unspoken, and forgotten. Her book titles show this: Weaving the Sermon, Preaching in a Feminist Perspective, Preaching as Weeping, Confession, and Resistance, Radical Responses to Radical Evil, Preaching Justice, Ethnic and Cultural Perspectives, and the latest, Risking the Terror, Resurrection in This Life. She is the professor of preaching and worship at United Theological Seminary of the Twin Cities. She earned her Master of Arts and Master of Divinity degrees from the Methodist School in Ohio, and her PhD in preaching and liturgy is from that great school in the West, the Graduate Theological Union. She was ordained in the United Methodist Church and served parishes in Ohio. She is now ordained in the United Church of Christ with the Minnesota Conference, and serves not just by teaching and preaching, but even by taking on such duties as assistant moderator of the General Synod in 2003. Chris is a much sought-after preacher and lecturer, both nationally and internationally, and ever since her days at Princeton, she has been escorting students on immersion cross-cultural trips. She is going once again to Guatemala this January, about the same time that LTS students will be heading for Ghana. Some might see Chris Smith as an issue preacher: social justice, human rights, LGBT activist. None of these titles would probably be too upsetting to her, but perhaps her work can be named more broadly. For in attending to the null curriculum, Chris prods the church to see what it has forgotten. She names resurrection. and constantly calls all to resurrection faith in action. Not only resurrection to be trotted out once a year on Easter Sunday, or that which is thought to be better left in the hands of professionals, but resurrection, present, relentless, abundant, now. Chris speaks in our midst today, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender voices transforming the church. It is an honor to introduce to you the Reverend Dr. Christine Smith.
Wow. I don't think I've ever had an introduction like that. I appreciate it very much, Jennifer. I want to say how honored I am to be here. I've never been to Lancaster Seminary, and I'm thrilled to be here and honored to have been invited. And I want to thank Jennifer. I want to thank Bruce as the two kind of contact people in addition to Jen Glass. Those were the three people who kept sending me emails and keeping me up to date on what was happening during this week of celebration for you. I also just want to say you have my complete admiration as an institution, as a seminary, for your prophetic witness doing this for 5 years now. I think it's quite incredible. I grew up in Ohio and know a little bit about this area, so I have some sense of what this witness must mean. And I thank you because we know, don't we, that this is about human lives, and a lot of GLBT people just aren't making it. They're dying in our midst and losing kids and being disowned by families. And so this is really a very huge and injustice and form of violence. And so thank you for your bold and brave witness. Keep at it. I want to start, because I think it's so important in the midst of so much silence of GLBT voices, I want to start, but I try to always start with this because I think that there's been way too much done in the church in the name of some kind of objectivity, that we're all so subjective and we start from our own particular social locations. So just a little bit about me, but I hope it has everything to do with you, and that I hope that everything I say, by the way, I mean, there is simply no way that we can change the world in which we live and make it more just in all kinds of ways, including ways for GLBT folks, unless we work together. So the whole theme of allies seems so profound and important, essential. I don't think that anything I have to say, it seems to me everything I have to say has everything to do with our common work together, even though I'll be focused more on GLBT themes and things that voices are voices, but I think they have everything to do with our common work. So, well, I knew from the time I was quite young that I was different. That's the way we all talk about it in the community. From the middle of my adolescent years, I have known that I'm a lesbian. These early years were years of complete silence, a lot of alienation, isolation, and total terror. I first came out to my parents, my mom actually, and then later my dad, my sister, in my early 20s. And after that, a few close friends in my early seminary years, but not very many. So I think I will never forget that how lonely those seminary years were for me as a lesbian woman. And then, bit by bit, my circle of friends and confidants began to expand until I finally discovered the larger feminist lesbian community of Ohio State in Columbus, Ohio. And when that happened, my world completely changed. I simply didn't know that community existed. So in my generation of lesbians, our coming out is so intertwined with feminism. And that discovery was saved my life, I think. I was a pastor at the time, and so discovering that larger community, the closet door began to swing open, even though, again, with a lot of terror because I was a United Methodist. Given the realities of those closets for GLBT folks, I have been trying to find my voice, even though I appreciate all that Jennifer said, and I listen, and I think, gosh, it seems like I have found my voice, but really, I still keep trying to find my voice, my truth, my community, and much of my life as an out lesbian woman. I've spent so many years afraid of hurting my family, afraid of losing friends and colleagues, afraid of losing my job, afraid of losing my ordination, afraid for those things, for those were very real, and only recently now I finally don't have to fear my ordination, the loss of my ordination, or the loss of my job. But there's a lot more to fear that's a lot more subtle and kind of heinous in a way. I have been afraid that I dress and walk and talk and move in the world in ways that are too much like a man to ever really be acceptable as a woman. We don't speak this honestly often, but this is the truth. I've spent a lifetime intentionally not wearing baseball caps, sneaking into the men's department store to buy shirts and jeans, sitting on fishing piers all across the country all night long, always with all groups of strangers, always all men, always kind of feeling like I'm not quite sure if I'm dressed okay, making myself for a period of my life carry a purse only to leave it every single place I took it. So I finally decided that was not going to... The wallet in the pocket was going to have to be my way. Laughing and making light when my nephew or niece heard somebody else call me sir. So it isn't just the big fears of job and violence done to our bodies, but those constant daily fears that somehow communicate to you that you're alien, that you are not quite what humanity wants you to be. In the past few years, again, some of that anxiety and fear and strangeness has lessened, but a lot of it still persists, and I believe that it persists for most of our lives as LGBT folks. For instance, I've never gotten used to the stares I still get. I get them all the time in terms of the kind of woman I am and the way I move in the world. I have felt deep shame when someone thinks that I am a man. I feel the crushing weight of silence when people make comments still, assuming that I love and desire, and my partner surely is a man, not a woman. I have wept uncontrollably at my own mom and dad's anniversary celebrations throughout the years, never knowing exactly why, but just feeling estranged. I've never become accustomed to always pulling the shades down in my own home. And actually, I hope I never do become accustomed to that. I've been a minister in the Christian church for over 26 years. It is painful as it is celebrative that only in the past few years am I finally now speaking and theologizing out of my lesbian voice and identity. At this point in my life, I'm trying to articulate some, joining a whole host of other voices, many of which are on the bibliography that was available to you. So we have a lot of voices now, thank goodness. Only a decade ago, we had not so many voices, particularly in church and theological and religious circles, writing and trying to articulate what are our theological, religious, and spiritual truths, which is what I would talk about as a constructive act, which means that when I wrote, Jen Glass asked, she said, can you just write me a paragraph or a couple sentences about what you're going to do? And where I started was I said, what I'm not going to do is the classic apologetics, which is to take on the text, the biblical texts of terror that keep violating our lives. I am not going to try to defend that somehow we really are human beings. I'm just simply unwilling to have those kind of conversations any longer. But I can tell you, this is where we so need all of you as allies. Some of those conversations cost us so much in terms of our energy and in terms of our lives, and keep us from getting to the work that the world really needs, which is the world needs our GLBT voices, our theological constructions, how we view the Bible, how we read the Bible, what we think about Jesus, how we understand a queer Christ, how we understand a queer God. This is the kind of thinking that if we're always defending our lives and our beings, we can never quite get to. So I said, I've I'm done with that kind of discussion. Not that it's not important, but and I pray for other people to take up the mantle of those hard conversations. But there's other work for the GLBT community to do, I think, at this point in history also. And it's no wonder that we have a difficult time finding our lives theologically and our voices. There is this deep smothering blanket in the church and in the world, isn't there? I mean, we could use all kinds of images, but it is this smothering, silencing blanket that if we keep trying to cast it off, we can sometimes cast it off long enough to breathe or to speak, but it just is pervasive again. I think about places I go, like Provincetown or Key West, or certain very unusual places in this country or in this world where you might actually feel the blanket is off your body and your voice for just a moment. But then you return home or you return to where life really goes on an everyday basis and the blanket is fierce. So I think it's really quite a miracle that we have, 50 books, and that's only the beginning on that bibliography, of Christian people, primarily religious people, who are finding their voices and are crafting a new theology. For many GLBT folks, it's also hard to find our voice, particularly in the church, because the church has been a source of our greatest fear. It has offered us life and hope and grace and resurrection, all the best that the church can be, but at a great cost. Closets, silences, and fundamental dishonesty, all those are very high costs. Queer people are us people struggling to find our voices, our theological truths, our communities, and churches that nurture and empower us, and it is almost always our responsibility to cast that smothering blanket off our minds and our bodies. So another task of our allies is help remove that smothering blanket. Invite us to speak. Speak in ways that create safe space so that we know we can speak. It sounds so simple, but it's so profound when you're afraid to speak on a daily basis. So in all the ways that you can imagine, removing a smothering blanket from your colleagues and your loved ones and your friends, we give thanks for the multiple ways all of us are trying to remove that blanket. One of the ways, again, the church... There's a poem that describes one of the ways the church, for me, has constructed its relationship with GLBT community that makes, again, this smothering blanket so huge and so difficult to remove. And it's a poem I return to over and over again to just remind me, even when I'm tempted to have this kind of relationship with the church. It's a poem by a Japanese-American woman named Mitsuyi Yamada, and it's called Playing Cards with the Jailer. A brief metallic sound jars the quiet night air, hangs in my ears. I am playing cards with the jailer, who shifts his ample body in his chair while I fix my smile on his cards, waiting. My eyes unfocused on the floor behind him where a set of keys, spider-like, begin to creep slowly across the room. Come on, come on, it's your play, I say. To distract him, I tap on the table and wait. With a wide gesture, he picks up the keys, hangs them back on the nook, yawns. The inmates will keep trying. Their collective minds pull the keys only halfway across the room each time. The world comes awake in the morning to a stupor. My brown, calloused hands guard two queens and an ace. My polished pink nails shine in the almost light. I have been playing cards with jailers for too many years. There are growing numbers of GLBT people who understand fully that every single category of religion, faith, theology, and life have been defined by the jailers of privilege and imperialism, jailers of heterosexism. For the GLBT folks to become prophetic voices that we might be able to become, we have to stop waiting to be freed by the church. And we must discern carefully all the ways we continue to play with the jailer, and that relationship will never set us free. What courage it takes to stop playing with the jailer. I'm amazed, again, that so many of us seem to have the courage to at least try to do that. Some of us do that by simply walking away from the church and leaving, thousands and thousands of us. Others of us try to stay and try to figure out how we can actually live our lives with integrity without playing with the jailer and begging, really, for the rights of our lives and the rights of our humanity constantly. One of the first theological assertions that GLBT people are making with their lives is that survival and resistance are powerful expressions of religious vocation, ethical agency, and profound faithfulness. Carter Hayward, a lesbian Episcopal priest who's been at this for so long, talk about one of our great lesbian mothers and sisters, she talks about this resistance ministry with these words. If we are to live with our feet on the ground, in touch with reality, we must help one another accept the fact that we who are Christian are heirs to a body-despising, woman-fearing, sexually repressive religious tradition. If we are to continue as members of the church, we must challenge this tradition at its root. GLBT folks are challenging a lot of us and a lot of the church to dismantle its theology. We are urging the church to stop denying the rising number of teenage suicides among GLBT youth. We are asking the church to probe the theological and religious dimensions of coming out as sacrament, coming out as utterly salvific action for GLBT people. We are asking the church to continue dealing with the haunting and violent distortions of selective biblical texts, and the positive powerful connections we're asking the church to explore between the erotic power of God's love and God's redemptive activity and all of our sexual embodied lives. To understand really the quality and character of the GLBT lives, or our GLBT lives, you must understand the deep religious and theological significance of struggle, survival, and resistance. To me, those have become, not just in my own GLBT experience, but as I've worked with all the systems of oppression, resistance, struggle, survival, those are theological and ethical issues. They're not just sociological kind of ways that we survive or ways we make it in the larger world. They have religious and ethical importance. And again, to be written about, talked about, thought about. Perhaps our individual and collective religious task is not just embracing the exile, as John Fortunato years ago in his Brave book talked about, but perhaps it's about empowering the resistance community of the GLBT community to lead the church actually into new life. So resistance and survival, ethical and theological issues in and of themselves. I want to say a word about heterosexism. I just simply don't know. For me, I cannot talk about GLBT reality without talking about the root of the cause for me, which is heterosexism. And I never assume that any of us in the GLBT community or our allies are anywhere near on the same page about this. So just a brief word about what I understand to be the root cause of the oppression that we experience. Heterosexism is the systemic denial, domination, and oppression of GLBT by GLBT folks by a heterosexist world. Condemnation seems like the most fitting word that I've found to describe the astonishing violence perpetrated upon us. To describe the oppression of GLBT folks as an experience of invisibility or silence to me just is way too benign. It's an experience of active, deliberate violence of all kinds and all levels. So for me, it's much stronger than just that we're invisible or silent. We are violated in all kinds of ways, rendered invisible and harassed, excluded, persecuted. I know of no better word than active condemnation. The relational and social values and experiences of our lives are not simply silenced again. They are judged inferior, deviant, sick. This kind of condemnation mostly comes, and I think is perpetuated, by the Christian church and its theology and its biblical understandings. The realities of heterosexism reflect the root cause of the condemnation and violence, for me anyway. Heterosexism is one of those fundamental structuring of our social reality, suggesting, period, that the only relationships that are considered normative, healthy, and acceptable are heterosexual. Heterosexism is built upon the assumptions that relationships between men and women have primary relational meaning, exclusive social sanction, and superior moral and ethical value. The structuring of our social, political, and religious life is so foundational that the primary relations between persons of the same gender are deemed immature at best and immoral, unnatural, and sinful at worst. And for me, hetero relations, and this is not something a lot of folks, even in the GLBT community, would necessarily talk about or agree about, but for me, hetero relations as an institution, and Adrienne Rich calls that compulsory heterosexuality, and heterosexism cannot be divorced or understood apart from sexism and male domination. These are hard words to speak, but I think we have to speak them, or at least I have to even have a foundation out of which we can talk about other things. I'm in agreement with so many of the scholars and writers who believe that heterosexism is a tool of sexism, actually, and cannot be understood apart from the larger analysis of patriarchy and male domination. In a world of male domination, it is totally unacceptable for a woman to choose a woman. Domination of women must be maintained, and for that domination to be maintained, there must be constant and institutionalized access to women's minds, bodies, hearts, labor, lives. In a heterosexist society, it is equally unacceptable for a man to choose another man. Male domination is maintained only if men fulfill their dominating roles. When men step outside these dominating roles, there is often, as we know, a violent and quick response. Visible gay men are the objects of such extreme hatred and fear by heterosexual men in this culture because, for me at least, they are breaking ranks with male heterosexual solidarity and gender-dominant solidarity. And this is seen as absolutely unforgivable. The system cannot maintain itself or can maintain itself only if gender relations are rigidly structured and controlled. And this is done through strict gender roles, through the institutions of traditional marriage and the nuclear family as that which is expected of all of us as an institution. So please don't hear me as being anti-marriage, but I'm talking about the enforcement of that as an institution upon all of our lives, and through compulsory heterosexuality, that we all must be heterosexual and live heterosexual lives. The violent power of homophobia and heterosexism to me is so severe. And I just want to stop and talk from the heart for just a second. Because as I've lived my life, I never, ever could understand, nor could I accept, that this issue was really about sexuality. I think it is about sexuality, partly. But it never has... I simply don't think that the world would react, the amount of violence done to GLBT folks, I simply do not believe that would happen if this was primarily a sexual issue instead of it, I think, primarily is a gender issue and challenges the entire system of male domination and gender relationships. To me, that is so much more radical than the sexuality issue and explains, at least for me, why the level of violence. The church is a sexually repressive institution, to be sure, and a body-hating institution, but I simply don't think we'd have the level of violence toward this community, toward us, for that reason only. You know, we can hold that and be glad to talk about it and reflect on it and struggle with it. And then I want to just make another observation, and then I want to move on to a couple of theological issues. One of the observations I want to make is when, and I notice this sometimes in my own language, but I'm really trying to change this, when you hear people talk about all the systemic forms of oppression, racism or white racism, imperialism, classism, sexism, One of the things that often happens is in that listing is that people will be listing and then they will say sexism, homophobia, ageism, ableism. And I just want to invite you to consider that homophobia, as important as that is to dismantle the fear of GLBT folks, to me, homophobia describes an internal, personalized fear that we as individuals and collectively have, but it does not describe the system of oppression the same way as naming heterosexism. And this seldom gets named. I mean, along with the list of isms, I just want to invite you to think about that naming homophobia is not the same thing as naming the cause of the problem is heterosexism, which means that really homophobia and our gender rigid expectations and rules have been institutionalized. That's what heterosexism is, but it's so important to get to that point of naming that institutional reality. Now let me shift gears just a little bit and talk about a few theological issues, but before I even do that, I want to show you a video clip and just try to set these theological issues in a larger context. Let me share the video clip and then the comments. This is just a very brief clip, 2-3 minutes, of a movie called Before Stonewall. It's a piece of our history. It's very precious, and it can slip out of our consciousness all too easily. But this was in 1969 when the Stonewall rebellion and uprising happened, and it really began the creation of a global movement that had already started, but it crystallized it.
Came along, just everything came together at that one moment. People quite often ask, well, what was special about that night, Friday, June 27th, 1969? There was no one thing that was special about it. It was just everything coming together. One of those moments in history where if you were there, you just knew, this is it. This is what we've been waiting for.
Decided, you know, we've had enough of this kind of thing. We're going to fight back. The patrons, instead of timidly taking it, they actually hurled rocks and bottles right back at the police. And the rioting went on for a couple of days.
The Stonewall coming all the way up and down and in across the bottom.
Well, the next few nights really were a repetition of the rioting.
All of a sudden, a lot of gay people would appear on the streets. In this whole area, not just in front of the Stonewall.
Fire alarm boxes were pulled, trash cans were set on fire.
So there was a chance of gay power, I remember that.
And I felt the injustice, and it was that expression of feeling that radiated across the country.
It gave me the courage to also come out and say no more as far as my work was concerned, as far as my private life is concerned. And that's what I really became a gay activist, and it was helped by that movement. The spirit of that movement carried all the way out to the West Coast. Wouldn't you agree, Morris?
Yes, Paul.
Yes, yes.
I'm gay and I'm proud, I'll sing it aloud. I'm not afraid to be me anymore. Tell your sister, tell your brother, it's okay to love one another. Sing it aloud, I'm gay and I'm proud.
Really turned at the time of Stonewall, a large number of gay people who had not known about the movement before heard about it and said, I'm going to join this or I'm going to start something of my own.
Oh, I'm not afraid to be me. Tell your sister, tell your brother, it's okay to love one another. Sing it aloud and get a
joining and uniting all of us, we have really gained power. And even in small communities, whether it's Kalamazoo or Timbuktu, our voices are heard there. And from the time of Stonehenge to Stonewall, this has been the struggle, and we're winning.
Risking simplicity, I want to just make a few brief comments about the movement in general. because I've really struggled, and I continue to struggle as a member of the community, how we understand the struggle for liberation that we're involved in. And we are in no way a uniform community who understands the struggle in one way. There are such complex philosophies and strategies for change among our own community and among our allies, many of you, that I think it's important that we talk about this and not just make assumptions about how we understand the movement. So just these are just my own kind of categorizations, and anytime you do this, you risk being too simplistic, as I've said. But I would just describe three areas that I see that and ways people within the community and our allies talk about the movement for change that we're all involved in. Some GLBT people want to be integrated into the mainstream culture and church with all the rights, privileges, and acknowledgments that accompany heterosexual relationships. I would describe this arm of the movement as a movement for personal and social equal rights. Persons who voice this position do not necessarily raise a serious critique of the fundamental nature of our social, political, and ecclesiastical reality. Nor would they necessarily see that which affects the lives of GLBT people as systemic oppression. And I'm not making fun of this position. This is a very needed position. Our basic human rights are at stake. We know this all too well after the last election. But in some ways, a quick way to say this is that that there are lots of GLBT folks who want a piece of the heterosexual pie, if you will, or the world pie with all its rights and privileges, but don't fundamentally think there's anything wrong with the pie. And so that's one perspective. Give me my particular rights and let me join you in this larger social system that's at some level fundamentally okay and doesn't have to be changed in at least a radical way. The second arm that I would describe is there are some GLBT people who are forging a movement toward greater relational freedom and sexual choice. I would describe this arm of the movement as a movement towards sexual liberation. Persons who voice this position also do not necessarily raise a serious critique of systemic and social structures. Rather, the primary issue is freedom of expression, freedom to love, freedom to choose a life partner, freedom to have freedom in our relational and sexual lives. Work from this perspective might involve forging a positive sacramental understanding of human embodiment and sexuality. A third group of people want to create and shape new understandings of relational life, new understandings of gender identity, gender fullness or gender independence rather than gender complementarity, i.e. you have to have a man and a woman, a male, a female, to be really whole in the society or in human life, new understandings of sexuality, community, covenanted relationships, theology, spirituality. I would describe this arm of the movement as a movement toward radical, social, and ecclesiastical transformation. You can guess where I locate my own analysis. It's in this third place that I think there are a lot of us who are saying the pie is such a distortion, is so oppressive for all of us, we need to create new systems and a new social order. It's just that large and that radical. So for those folks questioning all kinds of issues around gender and sexuality and community and oppressions of all different kinds, these also, I would say, in general, again, could be too simplistic, would be people in the GLBT community who clearly see themselves as needing to be allies with people experiencing white racism and people experiencing the imperialism of the United States and people experiencing ableism and ageism, who would have a kind of systemic analysis that understand that GLBT oppression is fundamentally linked with every other kind of human oppression and the oppression of the earth itself. So for instance, just to show just a little bit about how complicated this is, for instance, lesbian feminists who see the movement as one of social and systemic change often part ways significantly, sometimes at least, with some gay men who see the movement as only one of sexual freedom and liberation. This is not the stereotype, these are just examples. or gay men who believe the struggle is one of equal rights only, will have a difficult time understanding the separatist politics of an organization like Queer Nation, or the radical gender critique embodied by Radical Fairies. Part of why it is so difficult for us to find our voices and our truths in our communities is that we are reluctant, I think, to admit to each other, and very reluctant, and I think it involves a great deal of trust to admit to our allies and communities outside of our own community, that we have some very serious and social and theological disagreements, quite honestly. We are not a monolithic culture or community. We are nowhere close to being united across social and political lines, across gender lines, across sexual orientation / preference lines, across any lines. One might say that one thing we have in common is oppression. Yet even the ways we understand that oppression are so fundamentally different as to make this affirmation almost meaningless. I only know that there is so much work to do in understanding the great diverse voices among us. And all that you can do, again, to create the kind of safe space in places like this week and events like this week where voices can emerge and people can honestly talk. And GLBT folks, we need to do that work, but we also need your support and your encouragement. Because we are not unified, nor should we have to be unified. We are a relatively new movement trying to find who we are and what we're about, and what kind of liberation ultimately we will help bring about in this world. Now, a quick word about resurrection and then about gender. I spend a lot of time, I'm looking at the time, and I'm a little frustrated, but it's okay. I understand, this always happens, and we'll continue talking through lunch and around the edges, and I'm here all afternoon. And for me, I want to claim, and I'm not the only one in the GLBT community, I want to claim resurrection as an important theological category that we are beginning to talk about in some really different ways. Chris Glasser talks about it as a sacrament, that for GLBT folks who have lived their lives in closets, that it is no less than literally a sacramental act to come out of the closet, and has written an entire book about that. So coming out as sacrament. I would also share just some other images from some of, I'm wanting to summarize here kind of quickly. There are some images that Julia Penelope and Susan Wolf in Coming Out Stories talks about resurrection as sacrificing the death of narrow confining spaces, and they talk about the nautilus shell. They use a nautilus shell as a metaphor for this, that as one comes out more and more and more, one has to risk vacating chamber after chamber of security in order to grow into a larger emerging self. Other GLBT theologians and voices have talked about resurrection as political resistance. For some, it is the act of constructing community and culture, that is a resurrecting act, as we have the faith and courage to find one another. And in my generation, the primary place you found one another were in bars. It was about the only place you could find one another. And it still is a primary place. We should be appalled as a church that GLBT folks still find each other initially, and I would even say primarily, in bars. This is not a moralizing about alcohol. This is where people feel safe and where they find their own tribe and kin and feel safe to be who they are. So resurrection also has to do with however GLBT people have the courage to create community. It also has to do with moral and ethical truth-telling. When we refuse to tell lies anymore, that is a moment of resurrection. When we experience self-possession, taking hold literally of parts of ourselves, let me assure you, I wear ball caps now. I do a lot of things now. I don't go passively inching my way into the men's department anymore, although sometimes I'm. But as GOBT folks come into their fullness and are not only not embarrassed about that, but are proud of that, that is an act of resurrection. For some of us, it is an act of healing. I'd say for all of us, it is an act of healing of the harm done for so long and in so many ways. There are other writers who talk about resurrection as insurrection. I say that often Stonewall gets talked about as the riots at Stonewall. I think it was an uprising. It was a moment of insurrection where a group of people said no, no more. And in that, I think resurrection happened. A final couple of comments about gender, because this seems so important to me anyway, and so radical. Marilyn Frye's work, in a kind of humorous, poignant way, she tries to point out the idolatrous nature of rigidly maintained gender constructions in these words. And I love this quote because I think there's so much truth in it. She said, "It is quite a spectacle, really, once one sees it, these humans, so devoid to dressing up and acting out and fixing one another, so everyone lives up to and lives out the theory that there are two sharply distinct sexes, genders, and never the twain shall overlap or be confused or conflated. These humans constantly and with remarkable lack of embarrassment, marking a distinction between two sexes as though their lives depended on it. It is wonderful that homosexuals and lesbians are mocked and judged for playing butch femme roles and for dressing in butch femme drag, for nobody goes about in full public view as thoroughly decked out in butch and femme drag as respectable heterosexuals. When they are dressed up to go out in the evening or go to church or go to the office, heterosexual critics of queers role-playing ought to look at themselves in the mirror on their way out for a night on the town to see who's in drag. The answer is, everybody is. Perhaps the main difference between heterosexuals and queers is that when queers go forth in drag, they know they are engaged in theater, they are playing, and they know they're playing. The man in the hat, that's camp, that's theater, that's to me, salvific activity, by the way. The whole camping humorous dimension of the GLBT community, I think we need a ton of theologizing about that. It's kept people alive. But she said, heterosexuals usually are taking it all perfectly seriously, thinking they are in the real world, thinking they are the real world. Now, as humorous as Frye's words are, I think they confront religious people with a frightening truth. Many GLBT people believe in profound ways that gender roles and the societal construction of manhood and womanhood, the blatant and constant gender announcing we're all forced to do, that these are results of a system of power and control that are less than God's full intentions for humanity. Drag, theater, are constructions of our own making. They are just that, constructions. They are not necessarily the way God intended us to live. They are not God's incarnational intentions. Many of us have so fundamentally accepted gender identity, gender roles, gender distinctions as realities, these dimensions of our human experience have become some of the most poignant faces of idolatry. Nothing about gender for me is divinely ordained. Nothing about gender distinction is inherent in our fundamental humanness. Our unquestioning acceptance of rigid gender constructions fundamentally, I think, places us in direct opposition to the ultimate incarnational power and possibility of God. God's incarnational presence and power will not be restricted, obviously, to our gender definitions. GLBT people do not just symbolize and embody different sexual lives. They embody, I think, a kind of different anthropology, a different humanness that does not and will not accept gender, maleness, femaleness, masculinity, femininity, and all the ways gender has been defined and constructed as normative for all of our human life. So for many GLBT people, we are striving to build, as a recent University of Minnesota conference powerfully suggested, differently gendered lives. We are striving to build a world where those who break out of gender restrictions are given the holy recognition they deserve. and where the promise of us all being safe and being able to be fully embodied just as we are, however God has made us and called us forth, is blessed and protected and honored. I want to end with a poem called Sissy by James White. He struts down the street in his fur coat, his tight jeans, his permed red hair, sailing past department store windows, master of a select martial art, spears passing through him as though through fire. He looks back at me and smiles, readjusts his shoulder bag, and I, knowing a new found duty to myself, stop an automatic cruel judgment. Instead, I make a bowing gesture, and like blossoms and wings come words, thank you, Miss Thing, for the revolution. Thank you, Mary, for my life. Amen.